Okay, there we go. The changeover has happened. And now it's the time for the Dhamma talk. And as usual, people have been writing letters, sending faxes for the subject of tonight's Dhamma talk. And someone sent a fax, something to do with Buddhism and prison issues. And I meant to read that fax before I came in here to remind myself what those issues were, but I was so busy because people were talking to me all the time. So it's something to do with prison. I'm not quite sure what, so let's see what comes out. And not only that, but just we use these specific instances to outline just basic Buddhist principles. So it's as if the idea of prison issues is a vehicle for getting some deeper understanding of how Buddhists deal with different problems in life, especially things which either specifically or metaphorically deal with the idea of being in jail. I know actually it comes to my mind that many, many years ago, so I might confess this is a confession here, that I was visiting an old school friend. And this old school friend, it was Christmas time, about this time. And it's my old school friend, he had a couple of daughters, they were only about 5 or 6. And so it was at Christmas time and they were playing Monopoly. And so I said, oh, why didn't the monk have a go as well? So as a monk, I played Monopoly. The trouble was, after a very short time, I went to jail. It was very embarrassing for a monk to go to jail. It was only a game, though. But my friend who had some idea of Buddhism, my friend who decided to make good karma, he paid the $50 and got me out of jail for free. But anyway, in the end, I lost. I'm not very good at such things. I should stick to being a monk. But the point is that sometimes that one of the first things about jail, the whole idea of it, is sometimes in some traditions, especially in the Western tradition, the idea of a jail is to do with punishment. And I think that many of you who have been here for a long time, who understand some of the deep ideas of Buddhism, know that Buddhism doesn't have any concept of you having to punish somebody else. Some great sayings of the Buddha: to put aside the sword, put aside the rod. People who have been abused and you want to abuse the abuser back. You know that the Buddha said, he beat me, he abused me, he cheated me. The problem doesn't end with a person who thinks like that. If you actually let that go, if you forgive, if you put that aside, then the problem finishes. So too often the idea of a prison is to do with punishment. And the idea of punishment comes from a wrong way of looking at things. I think at the retreat, this is a story in the book. It was an event which changed some of the way I looked at crime and punishment. It was that a passage from a book called Erewhon. It was nowhere spelt backwards. A book written by Samuel Butler over 100 years ago, where he just envisaged a society in which people were punished, they were sent to jail, if they were sick, if they had some sort of disease. However, if they committed a crime like robbery, they just went to see a doctor, and they were healed, the doctor gave them some sort of medicine, some treatment to heal their sickness. Crime was looked upon as being a sickness, and sickness was looked upon as being a crime. And it was fascinating because one of the great little vignettes, little stories within the story, was of this poor man who was being tried. He was in the dock. He'd already been convicted. It was an obvious case. His crime was he had a cold. And it wasn't the first time he had a cold. The judge was berating him, saying, sir, this is not the first time you've appeared before me. You have a cold again. I warned you last time, you better look after your health. Because it was his problem. It's his fault. He ate junk food. He never exercised. He never looked after his health. It is your fault. And he said, right, I've forgiven you enough times, 6 years. Because he was a repeat offender, having a cold. Isn't it your fault, having colds, having sicknesses? Because you Because you don't come here on a Friday evening and meditate. That's the reason why you get sick. So you only got no one else to blame but yourself. Not eating the right food, not exercising. And you're costing our society billions of dollars. All you sick people, we're going to send you all to jail. Now, of course, if you look at it that way, I mean, there's some sort of logic behind that, isn't there? I don't agree with the logic, but there's some sort of logic behind it. Because sometimes, is sickness your responsibility? You don't look after yourself, don't eat good food, don't exercise, worry too much, push yourself too hard. The point he was actually saying there is, why is it we use that argument it's somebody's fault for crime? We don't use it for sickness. Using that juxtaposition made things quite clear. Just as it would be, I think, irrational, illogical, unfair when someone's got a sickness, even if it is their fault. You don't punish that. We heal that. We give that compassion. We give that care when somebody's sick. We look after them to heal their sickness for their well-being as much as anybody else's. So why is it when somebody commits a crime do we feel that punishment is a necessary remedy? I've known in my time as a Buddhist that punishment doesn't really do very much at all. Certainly remember at school, if I got punished because I got caught doing something wrong, the only thing I learnt was not to get caught again. Just to be a bit more skillful, a bit more sneaky, that's what it taught me. It never taught me really sort of that I shouldn't do something wrong, because I didn't understand what was going on there. So punishment, very often that all it does, sometimes it makes the matter worse. And I'll go on to that in a few moments. But first of all, the idea of right punishments, is that really what the point is of jails? Surely the point of a jail would be of rehabilitation. Sometimes you do need to sort of put people aside to confine them because they can be a danger to themselves as much as a danger to others, in the same way that we put people in isolation, in quarantine, if they've got a great sickness. That's fair enough. So certainly that prisons or places of confinement are necessary in our society, but not as a punishment. Because really, do you really learn from being punished when we do something wrong? How many times have you been punished, and what do you learn from it? Sometimes you learn not to love your punishers anymore. It's happened many times that parents who punish their children think that they need to be told. But many times the children wonder, how can my father, my mother do that? And it doesn't really solve the problem. It actually takes away the love, the care. There are other ways to deal with the problem. When we go to the idea that if you hurt me, I have to punish you back, we go from looking after our children that way, we go to treating our offenders that way, in the end we start wars. You've invaded my country, I'll invade yours. You've sort of blown up my brother, I'm going to blow up your family. And you can see where that tit for tat comes from. Someone has done something terrible to our society, to our country, to my family, to me. Therefore I have to do something back. That idea of revenge, which is at the core of punishment, I think really needs to be looked at and reflected upon deeply. Is that the way we want to live our world? Is that the way we want for our future? Because sometimes, do we deserve punishment as well then? Is there anyone here who's been so squeaky clean in their life? Is something that they've never done anything wrong? Punishment, I don't think, is the way in our world. It's just far too dangerous. It generates too much ill will, too much bad feeling, and actually stops us progressing further in peace and harmony and prosperity in our world. So instead of actually punishment, we need to actually have to learning. A rehabilitative sort of prison service, where rehabilitation rather than punitive measures are what's really needed. And so in such a situation that you'd expect a person to maybe be put in jail for as long as it takes for them to learn, to grow, to understand what happened and why, so they could never do that again. In the same way a person is in hospital for as long as it takes them to heal. Now that is a bit sort of radical, and sometimes people say, you can't do that. Some people are just so evil, so terrible. But why do we need to punish? What does that really do? What does that teach our children, not teach other people in this world? It just legitimizes violence, it legitimizes harm, it legitimizes creating suffering for others. And of course, most people who want such revenge on the people who have hurt us, sometimes it's just because of the way we've been brought up. Sometimes we really feel that that's what really needs to be done. The idea of it being a deterrent just does not work. There was a classic study which was done in the UK 100 years ago, where somebody went to one of the jails. They did a survey of all the people who were waiting in that jail to be hung. In those days there was capital punishment for small crimes, and they found out that I think 95% of those who were waiting to be executed had themselves witnessed public executions. They'd seen somebody being hung, let alone actually reading about it. This was in England 100 years ago. So much for the idea of deterrent. The problem is we want to stop crime, we want to stop hurt, we want to stop the suffering which some people cause on others. But does that really work? Can there be another way? Any person who's really done the research, who knows what goes on, knows that it does not work. It creates a huge, it takes a huge amount of resources from our society. And what do we get out of it afterwards? Not very much. But so there's another way of doing this, and that is actually rehabilitation. And just the same way that that's a Buddhist way of dealing with crime, or dealing with punishment, rehabilitation rather than crime, it's the same way we deal with the wrongdoings in our family and the wrongdoings in ourselves, or the wrongdoings in life. If it's your wife or your husband who does something wrong, we don't condone domestic violence. We don't even condone verbal violence and shouting at each other, trying to get your own back. They've done something to me, I've got to really teach them a lesson. That never works, that creates more violence. And the same way when you've done something wrong, you try and punish yourself. And what's that called? Guilt. That's why I've noticed many years ago that trying to shout or punish another, what do we call anger, or trying to shout and punish yourself, which is called guilt, or putting people in prison because we want to teach them a lesson, they're all coming from the same place, the same idea, the same model of vindictiveness. For a society who puts people in jail, they're a society who is motivated by anger, and a society whose individuals will feel a lot of guilt. It all goes together. The same attitude, either either an attitude which is focused on the criminals, attitude which is focused on your partners or other people who are just tantamount criminals, or yourself, your own criminal activity. In other words, the wrong things you do. And the other way, which you've heard here, which is encouraged in Buddhism, whatever you've done which is wrong, you don't put yourself in jail, you don't punish yourself, you acknowledge, you forgive, you learn. AFL code. Acknowledge what you've done, forgive it and learn from it. That is a way to heal the problem, so you don't do the same thing again. Your partner, a friend, does something, acknowledge, forgive, learn. Whether it's a person who's done a crime, acknowledge. They should acknowledge what they've done. Somehow some sort of forgiveness. In other words, not to punish themselves, or not to other people to punish them, and learn from it. Try and heal the reason why we do those things. I think that's the only way we're going to have a psychologically sound society. However, that too often we put ourselves in what's called the prison of guilt. Sometimes we put ourselves in the prison of anger. There's a story which was in one of the books recently about these two men who'd been in a prison of war camps in the Second World War under the Japanese. And one of them said to the other, sort of, have you forgiven those Japanese torturers yet? He said, I can never forgive those Japanese, mate. Just what they did to me and what I saw them do to some of my mates, I'll never be able to forgive them. What about you? He replied, I forgave those Japanese a long time ago. Some of them are my best friends now. I walked out of that prison camp about 10 years ago. You're still inside. What he said was very profound. It's only when he forgave his torturers that he was free. The other fellow who kept that anger, that hate, for all those years, was still inside the torture camp. Do you understand what this means? When we have anger towards somebody else, or when we have guilt towards ourselves, or when we try and seek revenge against some person who's done a criminal act, isn't that the case that we're allowing ourselves to hurt? We ourselves are in prison. The prison of guilt, the prison of anger, the prison of wanting revenge. So the high idea of Buddhism is actually having more freedom, healing for some reason or another, some way we can do this. So that when a person actually is in a prison, and of course that many of you know that I used to spend a long time visiting prisons when I was before I became the abbot. Sometimes I get too busy these days. I haven't got much time to do much these days. It's just 16-hour days sometimes I work. Actually not sometimes, most times. But anyhow, when I used to go and visiting prisons, you actually saw what it was like to be a prisoner. And I was actually used to laugh when some other monks would go into jails, or some of the lay supporters here. We've got a very active group who goes to visit most of the prisons in Western Australia. And I used to laugh when they would come back and say, hey, Ajahn Brahm, I've just been inside the prison. You know, they're just like us. And of course I laughed there, because what do you expect? But because that was something which was repeated to me again and again and again, there was a reason why they would make that comment. And the reason they make the comment that there is a sort of racism or speciesism or genderism, the same sort of thing which separates us, was separating in our society those people who were in jail and those people who were out of jail, as if they were some sort of different species. We have a tendency to do that in our society. Those are not the same as us. They're not the same type of people. They're genetically flawed. They are inferior. There's something wrong with them. In the same way we've done that with races in the past, we've done that with genders, we've done that with religions, we've done that with the free and the criminals. And of course, there is no difference between those people in jail and the people sitting here. Sometimes it's so easy to do what's called a crime, to be caught for it and end up in jail. Sometimes it's just one moment, lack of mindfulness, or sometimes all the causes and conditions which actually come together to get you into jail. It's amazing how karma works. I was reading this article in one of the newspapers, which I do to get more material for my talks. There was this guy in, I think it was actually in Los Angeles, who as a young boy, he was very badly abused at home, thrown out when he was about 7 years of age, if I remember correctly, and started living on the streets of LA from the age of seven. The very fact he survived was a miracle. When he got to his early teens, he couldn't really survive just on handouts. At that particular age, he started getting involved in crime, petty crime, and then going into juvenile detention centers, and then progressing to big crime. He was in and out of jail for a long, long time. And you can actually probably see why. He just had absolutely no chance of survival at that time. But anyhow, just amazing how the law of karma works. In his late 40s, or maybe mid-40s, that he was, he had a social worker. He was about to be released. The social worker was actually looking for some way that they can give him a proper job, so he didn't need to get into crime anymore, to try and heal the problem. And it just happened that she knew someone who was making a movie. And the person who's making the movie wanted to actually to make it more authentic. They wanted a consultant who actually knew something about how real criminals speak. And so she told him, I've got this guy in jail who's been a criminal, or been in and out of jail since the time he was 7. He needs a job, why don't you get him as a consultant? And actually the producer was a fellow called Quentin Tarantino. The film he was making was called Reservoir Dogs. And this prisoner was the consultant. He actually amended the script to say how real criminals actually talk. And apparently he was so good that he was actually put in the cast as one of the criminals. Now, I've never seen this movie. One of the monks said they have, and apparently all the criminals, all the gangsters, whatever they were given different colours or something, blue, red or yellow, is that correct? I don't know, anyway, that's what he said anyway, but he was one of them. And they said that he was the one which everybody watched, because he actually looked like a criminal, he wasn't the actor, all these other guys, I mean you could tell they were just actors, but this guy, not only had the speech, he had the actions right down as well. And so after that movie, of course, this ex-criminal made a fortune. And now he lives in Beverly Hills. He married his social worker. And he's and it's amazing. He just was writing this article, because I can't believe it. Now I've got this amazing mansion, this beautiful wife, a loving relationship, and heaps of money in the bank. Look where I came from. And good luck to him. The point was that you saw this poor guy, you know, being punished. He just wanted a way out. But sometimes there isn't a way out. I know certainly the reason why there isn't a way out, because what punishment does, in these jails where I used to go and visit, everyone is called a crim. They wear the uniform of prisoners, the green uniform here in Australia, or West Australia. They're called criminal day after day after day. They're treated like a criminal. And of course, after a few years of that, they become a criminal. So one of the things which I taught criminals, and one of the things which I would teach you as well, I said, why on earth do you call yourself a criminal? It's not because of the clothes you wear. It's not because of the place you're living. It's just like being a monk. Just because you wear brown robes and you live in a monastery does not make you a monk. Something deeper inside makes you a monk. If you're a criminal, are you a criminal? Why are you there? Why are you wearing those greens? Why are you living in this place? It's because one act which you did, or maybe a few series of acts. And I said, what else did you do that day? What else did you do the other days of the year? What else did you do all those years of your life? Can you really define yourself for maybe a fraction of a percent of everything you've ever done? Why do you call yourself a criminal? The point was that when you focused, or when those people in jail were focusing on the reason why they were there, while that was amplified by the dress they were, the place they were, and the way that people looked at them and regarded them, when that was the only thing they remembered, that's the only thing they were reminded of, of course, that became who they were. Because we're focusing on their misdeeds, they became their misdeeds. They became criminals. And it's very clear to me the psychology of why they would leave that place and go back soon afterwards. That's who they were. You know what it's like when a prisoner finishes their sentence and they get released? They're still looked upon as being ex-crims. In other words, they are criminals. They find it very hard to find a job, to find work. Because that one act is almost like a brand they wear on their forehead for the rest of their life. That's really unfair, unjust, irrational. Why should we judge anyone for one or two things which they've done in the past? If you focused on the other things they've done, then they can actually go beyond their crime. They can acknowledge, forgive, learn, and grow away from it. The story which comes up next is in that book. It's a story of psychology, which I'm going to repeat here because it makes the point of how what we believe we are, we actually become. It was a story which I learned as a school teacher in psychology, that there were two classes of children, same year, given an exam at the end of that year. Instead of grading the children into the top half went in one class, the bottom half went in the other class, they split the classes up absolutely equal. The way they did it was the top child plus the one who came fourth and fifth, the one who came eighth and ninth, the one who came 12th and 13th, and so on, went in one class. The one who came 2nd and 3rd, 6th and 7th, 10th and 11th, went in the other class. They split them up as evenly as possible, two classes of children. They gave teachers who were equally able, classrooms which had equal facilities. Everything was made equal as they possibly could, except for the one thing they called one class A, the other one class B. That was the only difference. They were children of equal ability. Imagine what would happen if your child went into class A. You think, well done, because you assume that class A is superior. The children who did well on those exams. Many of the parents were quite surprised that their child had made it into class A. Well, you haven't been doing any homework, but you must be doing something right. Here, have some extra pocket money. Other kids have gone into class B. No TV for you. You have to do better next year. And even the school teachers, if you thought you had the best class, you'd actually teach in a different way than if you thought you had the bottom half. So even the teachers taught differently to those children. And the children themselves thought, I'm a class A kid, I'm a class B kid. The point was, after 12 months, when they gave an exam again, the children in class A did so much better than the children in class B. In fact, they did just as you would expect, just as the statistics had shown, as if they were the top half from the year before. The class A children, even though they were no different than the class B children the year before, had become class A children. And the class B children, because they'd been told they were class B, because they were treated as class B, because they thought they were class B, became class B children. It's a classic experiment in educational psychology, which I use to explain why people go back to jail again and again and again. If you're in jail, you're called a criminal, you dress as a criminal, you're treated as a criminal, you start to think you're a criminal, you become a criminal. The same way, if you think that you are hopeless, and you believe you're hopeless, and your husband tells you you're hopeless, then you become hopeless. It's not your fault, it's his fault. You see how we condition each other and how we become that conditioning? So I made a big thing when I was visiting prisons to say, you are not a prisoner, you're a person who's done a crime. There's a lot of difference between you're a criminal and you are a person. You're a person who's done a crime. You're a person first. Your mistake is second. When you acknowledge you're a person first, there's an opportunity to go away from that crime. Same as your wife. Your wife may have done some terrible, terrible things, but she's a person first, a wife first, before those mistakes. Can't we actually stop focusing on the mistakes and becoming mistakes? If we focus on not the mistakes, but the other things, the good things, then there's a way out of anger, there's a way out of guilt, there's a way out of punishment. How can you punish anybody anyway? Okay, they made a mistake, but how many good things have they done? Sometimes when you look rationally at these things, there's no way of punishing at all. That story I did when I was visiting Malaysia at a university. When at question time, this lady put her hand up and said, my husband has just lied to me. I've caught him out lying. Should I get divorced? I'm contemplating divorce. And I said, madam, what are you doing at this university? And she said, I'm a lecturer. What subject? Maths. Okay, let's do some statistics. How long have you been married to the guy? About 3 years? Just for easy calculation, let's call that 1,000 days you've been married to him. Let's make an assumption, a reasonable assumption, that every day, on average, he said 20 things to you which could be right or could be wrong. So at the time you've been married, he said 20,000 things to you, and now he's lied for the first time. According to probability theory, that means the next time he says something to you, there's a 20,000 to 1 chance he's telling the truth. I think that's trustworthy. Don't get divorced. That's reason, isn't it? That's logic. But for her, the lie was the only thing she saw. And that's why she wanted to get divorced. Because she only saw one lie and she was blind to 20,000 true statements. She thought, I can't stand the guy anymore. I can't trust him. Get rid of him. Sometimes a person may have done 20,000 kind acts and now they've stolen or they've killed. Does that make them a criminal? Does that make them untrustworthy? It's the same psychology there. Sometimes we forget the 20,000 good things somebody has done. We think they're evil. They're bad. Let's put them in prison and never let them come out. That is wrong thinking. That's where punishment comes from. That's where anger comes from. Anger feels, judges the person and say they don't deserve any kindness because there's no goodness in them at all. In Buddhism, we have this wonderful thing called Buddha nature. Every being has got Buddha nature. How I understand that is everybody has got this beautiful potential to be the most wonderful, caring, kind, compassionate, wise saint. Everybody. Without exception. Even Osama bin Laden has got Buddha nature. Mr. Bush, he's got lots of Buddha nature. It's a bit hidden, but it's in there somewhere. What that means is actually you cannot sort of get so upset and angry at a person, you want to punish them, throw them away, kill them, destroy them, or whatever. Now when you actually start, I practiced that when I went into jails. The idea of Buddha nature was to try and see something in that person in jail which I could really respect and care for. Really respect. And a wonderful thing happened when I went to visit jails. Because I never saw the crime, but I saw the person. Because I tried and saw the beauty in every prisoner. Because that's what I was looking at. That's what they showed me. Some wonderful experiences in prison. I remember once this prisoner who was one of the tough guys in jail. This was in Canning Vale jail. I think, was it called Hakey or Acacia or something? I forget what it's called now. The old Canning Vale jail. I went in there and they had a series of violent attacks on staff and visitors, especially visitors, because visitors weren't really protected. The staff had some training. People like me, someone attacked me, what would I do? Let go, let go, let go. And it's a waste of time running. Can you run in these robes? It'll drop off and be even worse. So there's a lot of attacks in the prison. And so when I went in there for the weekly visit, at this sort of the place where you go in there, they told me, said, look, there's a new security system. It's top secret. They have these little like pens, like biro pens. You're supposed to put them in your little pocket, on your jacket or in your shirt, like each one of you got. I said, help, I haven't got any pockets. So I just carry it, put it somewhere. And so they said that if there's any trouble, you might see on the ceilings, there's these little, they look like the fire extinguishers. He said, they're not fire extinguishers, they're security system. You point that pen, press the top, and then the alarm will go off. And we'll also see exactly in the prison where you are, and we'll come for you, we'll get you within a couple of minutes, we'll save you. And it was, you know, some people had been beaten up, women had been raped inside the jail, because some of these guys had so long sentences, they'd never get out, they had nothing to lose. So they gave me this pen. They said, don't tell anyone, this is top secret. As soon as I went into my class, This guy, one of the tough guys, said, "Oh, you got one of those as well." They all knew exactly what was going on. There's no secrets there. And then he looked at me, this huge guy, and he said, "Brahm, do you think you could even get your finger to the top of that pen before we rushed you?" I looked at him and said, "Probably not." He said, "No, you wouldn't." But he said, "If any of these guys back here tried it, I would get them first. We like you." It was a goodness which protected me, not that pen. The kindness, that was the best protection, because there's no way you could actually be protected. Those guys were some very, very tough guys. And because I saw their little Buddha nature, their kindness, it's amazing just how they would protect you and care for you. I was probably one of the safest people in that jail. The guys, they would protect me. Even some years ago, there's another, I don't know if I'm going on the tangent here, this Vietnamese guy came just in the front by the door one morning and said, "I'm from one of the triads in Perth," he said. I thought, uh-oh. He said, "But don't need to worry. You know, you monks, you like Asians. So if any trouble, just give me a call. We'll sort it out." I didn't take his number. But the point is that goodness and kindness, when you see Buddha nature, even in these hoons, these hooligans, they never harm you. I remember being in England once, and it was a time of the punks. And I don't know if you remember the punks, and they had all these amazing sort of hairstyles. I remember actually seeing one the first time. I had a Mohican, and it was all sorts of weird stuff all over his body. And I saw him at the Perth airport many, many years ago. And I turned around to somebody, the person who was me, I said, "Look at him. Don't some people wear strange clothes?" Before I realized what I was saying. I never saw my own robes and bald head. I only saw somebody else's. But anyway, this particular time, this bunch of skinhead punk rockers, I don't know what they're called, came up to me. And I thought, I'm in trouble now. And actually, they just came up to me to actually ask for advice on how to shave your hair. They were just so sweet and kind. When you're kind of them, you see Buddha nature in them, they give you the Buddha nature back. So, we would know a lot about shaving hair and do it all the time. Anyway, this particular occasion, that when you actually look at people with Buddha nature in the jails, they're not criminals, they're people. You see the good part. Then I found that they saw it themselves. And that was one of the greatest ways of actually healing the problem. If you focus on the crime, then people sometimes get so depressed and upset, they just give up hope. They don't try and change. It's the same as if you're always arguing with your husband, with your wife about all the terrible things they've done. They're never going to change that way. Focusing on the faults grow. And I know from psychology, you don't focus on the faults, you focus on the good qualities. You don't learn by remembering the mistakes. You learn by remembering the successes. By focusing on them. And by focusing on the good qualities in those prisoners, the good qualities were the ones which grew. I call this watering the garden. If you water the weeds, that's trying to learn from the mistakes, all the rotten things which happened. Just the weeds grow. If you water the flowers, remember all the good things, focus on the good things, learn by the good things, you find the good things grow. Some years ago, I wrote this in a book, but I'm going to repeat it again. I got this beautiful phone call. I was in my office at Serpentine in the monastery. The phone rang, I picked it up. It was one of the senior prison officers from Carnet, the jail which I used to visit the most in those days. They said, "You haven't been for a long time. Can you come back?" I said, "Oh, look, I'm out of it now. It's just so busy." I said, "No, please, can you come back just to increase morale?" He said, "I've been here all these years. One thing I've noticed," he told me, "that all of the people who went to your group have never come back to jail. Can you please come back?" That's one of the most wonderful compliments I've received. People in the meditation groups, and the Buddhist groups which I took for many years, and never went back into jail. And that was what he told me as a prison officer. He should know, and I treasure that. So this is what we mean by rehabilitation. Let's let go of revenge. You know the story, what I say about revenge. If someone has hurt you and harmed you, the Buddha said, don't think like that. Don't try and punish them. If they're a Christian, then God will look after that when they die. If they're a Muslim, Allah will take care of it. If they're a Buddhist or a Hindu, karma will look after it. And if they're an atheist, and there are many atheists here, then they will have to go through psychotherapy for many years, which is very expensive. Whatever, they'll never get away with it. So why do you have to sacrifice your own happiness to be the punisher and executioner? You can forgive. They're not going to get away with it. So you don't need to be the one who teaches them a lesson. Life will teach that lesson. Your responsibility, your duty is to forgive. So that way, that the whole idea of being in a prison or looking after prisoners is to say they're people first, so that they're prisoners second. To remember that, so they at least get a bit of self-respect, a little bit of focused on what they're doing in there, who they are. They're not the crime, they're just the person. So that way they have this Buddha nature, people can treat them well. When they're treated well, they will become good people. People become just the people you expect them to be. And that way, there's a huge amount of growth. One of the other stories which comes to mind when I was teaching in jail, these two fellows. One of them was Nick. I think he was actually involved in the Argyle Diamond Robbery some time ago. I think he was one of those guys. He's somewhere involved in it. Anyway, Nick, he was a Greek fellow. Meet the Greek. But he's a really nice guy. And he was with one of his mates. And this was actually the time, I love telling this story because it's a very beautiful, wonderful story. This was the time when I visited one day and they immediately, or Nick especially, took me by the arm, come and have a look at this. It was in the schoolroom in Carnot. And on the wall there was all these beautiful cards. Dear Nick, I hope you get out soon. Amanda, aged 8. Dear Nick, it's so wonderful you visited our school. You know, Thomas, aged 9. 'Cause what had actually happened the week before, one of the teachers at a nearby school wanted to do some drug awareness program. And they were talking and thinking, how can we help our children to keep clear of the danger of drugs? First of all, they thought, let's get some professor from the university. They said, no, that's just words, concepts. Let's get some expert from social work department or the education department. Nah. Someone had the brainwave. Let's get one of the criminals who's in jail for drugs. Let's get him there. How better to teach about the danger of drugs than to get someone who's actually walked that path and known the pain of what actually happens if you get into drugs, what happens if you get caught and get sent to jail. They invited, so Nick must have been in there for drugs because he was one of the ones who went to this school with somebody else. They spent the whole afternoon with his primary school children saying what it's like. From experience, from bitter experience. They were the experts. And so that was a brilliant strategy, not only for the children, but actually to hear what it's really like, not as theory, but from practice, from experience, terrible experience. But for these two prisoners, they had a chance to give, to serve, to do something for others, to somehow pay off their debt. You don't just pay off your debt by sitting in a cell. A lot of that debt is paid off by contributing, giving back something of what you've taken. And those two prisoners had the chance to give. and they realize that what they'd given was something quite huge, influencing many kids not to ever get close to taking drugs. And so when he took me and showed me these cards, Nick just burst out crying, just weeping. You could see what that meant to him. He had the opportunity at last to do something, to pay something back. I think it's wonderful when those people who have committed crimes have the opportunity to become people again. One of the things I've seen in jail is nothing you can really do to care. In men's jails, there are no females usually, no kids. It's not a really sort of conducive environment for the men in jail. They need those children to make them feel soft. They need the wives or women there to get the feminine side. Otherwise, it's just such a macho sort of testosterone-filled place. It's the last they need. Last thing they need. So they went to see children one day, and they helped. A few years later, I was at Perth Airport again. I was waiting for a monk to come. Someone put their hand on my shoulder. I looked round. It was Nick in a nice suit. And he smiled at me. And I remember his words. He said, "Brahm, I'm still meditating. I still meditate every day." It was wonderful actually to see that. It actually worked. So that degree of like kindness, non-vindictiveness, not wanting to punish, but giving people an opportunity to rehabilitate themselves, to heal the sickness, which is crime, to try and find a way out. And to give them that way out. And in the end, it's the classic win-win situation. Those children learned so much, and those prisoners had a chance to abandon their feeling of guilt, to give up the harm which they've committed by helping. And focusing on that was probably one of the main reasons why they never reoffended. And it's the same way why if we've done something wrong or bad, and we have to forgive ourselves, but at least find some way of giving back if we have actually hurt somebody else. Or if we've hurt our family. Some way that we can balance our accounts. Buddha said that with bad karma, you can never get rid of bad karma. It's always there, if any faults you've done, but you can dilute it with good karma. In just the same way, a spoonful of salt was the Buddha's simile. Put in a glass will make the whole thing salty, but if you put a spoonful of salt in your swimming pool at home and stir it up, you won't be able to taste the salt. The same way, if bad karma is diluted with lots and lots of good karma, you don't even taste the result. So, if prisoners have done some bad karma, isn't it wonderful to give them opportunity to make lots and lots of good karma? That is a wonderful way of rehabilitating, healing the sickness of our bad actions. Put them in jail, they've got no opportunity to make good karma. If they are confined in a place, at least to try and have some way of doing something, some way of caring, some way of giving, some way of doing something for others to heal the badness. And that way I think that most people will not reoffend. People will be in jail for a time until they heal themselves, then they can become free again. But that's only one part of prison. Again, I also mentioned that sometimes we segregate prisoners and think they are some sort of subspecies. But they're just like you and I. Just in that way that we never look upon prisoners as being something different. They are the same as us. Therefore we can be compassionate. Therefore we can be kind. But the last thing is this: not just the prisons which are incarnate or casuarina, what we usually call prisons, because each one of us has our own little prisons. And sometimes, I don't know, sometimes some of you have been in prison who are sitting here. Sometimes it's waiting in front of you in the future. Who knows? Last week I got a letter from the police. It was in this brown envelope with this little checkered pattern on the outside. It was addressed to me. And straight away I thought, uh-oh, what am I up for? But actually, you know what I found? Inside there was a thank you note, because our local police had helped us on something. So we wrote this letter back, sort of praising them. which is often what we do. We say thank you for these two constables. We sent the letter off. We got the letter back from the police headquarters. This is the southern region. It was based in Mantua, the Peel region. Saying, oh, it's so nice to have somebody actually thanking the police. So I didn't need to be afraid. When you do good things and you recognize good things, I think those police will probably help us even more next time. They've got some people actually on their side, some people praising them. So if you want some help from the police, help them out. Praise them. So, but each one of us, sometimes we're not going to go in jail, a physical jail. Isn't it sometimes that we feel that sometimes our life is like a prison? Remember, I told a story to someone just before I came in here. It's a story about that monk who was teaching in jail, and told them, I'll go very quickly through this, told them about what it's like in a Buddhist monastery and how hard it is there, getting up 4 o'clock in the morning. Voluntary, of course. You can always get up earlier. And just one meal a day, all in the same bowl, with ice cream on top of curry, custard on top of spaghetti. That's happened to me many times. All mixed in the same bowl. I have to work really hard, sleep on the floor, no TV, no radio, no music, no sex, no sport. Even in prison we can have a TV. Even in prison we have a menu, we have a choice of food. We have separate plates. Not in a monastery. And we have beds in jail. Not in a monastery. And this particular time, these prisoners were so upset that their friend who was visiting them every week and who was caring for them was living in such a terrible situation that one of them, losing their mindfulness, forgetting where they were, said, that's terrible in your monastery. Why didn't you come in here and stay with us? I said. And of course everyone cracked up at that time, but you started thinking afterwards, why? Is the monastery down at Serpentine, or even the nuns' monastery at Gidgiganup, much harsher than any prison in Western Australia? But you have such a hard time trying to get in to one of our monasteries. There are waiting lists in both monasteries of people trying to join. No one wants to escape from our monastery. So I think so. I did count the monks before I came here. I'll have to count them again when I go back. No one wants to escape. Why? And the point is that the monks in Serpentine, the nuns in Dhammasara, they want to be there. That's why you never feel it's a prison. You feel you're free. Inside a prison, doesn't matter how comfortable it is, even if they have takeaway, dial service, if have a butler comes and feeds them or their meals every day, still, because they don't want to be there, that is called a prison. And from that I got this wonderful way of looking at life, that any place you do not want to be is called prison. If you are in a job which you hate, it's called prison. If you are in a relationship which you're not really quite happy about, you are in a prison. If you're in a body which is causing you pain and sickness, that is a prison. If you're in a life, this life which you're not really happy with, your life is a prison. The point is, it doesn't matter what that life is. It doesn't matter how your body is. Doesn't matter what your relationship is like, what they're doing. Doesn't matter what your job is. If you don't want to be there, that is a prison. You can change and escape from prison so easily just by changing your attitude and wanting to be here. One of the monks I really respect, he's passed away now, was a Thai monk who was put in jail for 2 years. He was a wonderful monk, very knowledgeable, good meditator, and also very skilled in administration. So he was given all these posts in the hierarchy of the Sangha, the group of monks in Thailand, until he was the deputy, what's called Sangharaja, the deputy chief monk. He was next in line to take that position of the chief monk of Thailand. However, there was another monk who was also third or fourth in line, who was jealous, and he wanted to become the senior monk himself. So he listened to some of this monk's sermons. This was 30-40 years ago. He listened to some of this monk's sermons. And of course, if you listen long enough, there'll always be something you say which is wrong. And this particular monk was accused of being a communist, which at that time was a crime in Thailand. And they took him to court. He was convicted and put in jail for 2 years just because of something he said in some of the talks was construed as being pro-communist. As far as this monk was concerned, and he wrote a little biography, he said, oh, it was such a wonderful thing which happened to him. Because all being a senior monk, being an abbot, there was all these people coming to him with their problems and asking him to give talks and asking him to bless their babies or to bless their marriage or to try and heal their divorce, and talking about this, and he's just so much headache. Now he's in jail, he was free, he could meditate all day. And he said it was the best time of his life, 2 years, it was like being on retreat. You know, sometimes we have these, people actually pay for these 9-day retreats. I had to work so hard to get 6-month retreat a few years ago. So it was 2 whole years. Oh, it was wonderful. I mean, that's actually his little cell in the jail in Thailand was actually more comfortable than the cell in his monastery. So he said it's a wonderful time. And actually, after 2 years, he was completely exonerated. They found out exactly what had happened. So they released him from jail, reinstated him, you know, with all of his robes and everything, and said sorry. But he didn't say, you don't have to say sorry. Oh, thank you so much for giving me 2 years of peace. So even though he was in a jail in Bangkok, for him, it was freedom. He was happy to be there. And I can see this is how it's the change of attitude which actually gives you that freedom. Now I say that because that's something which is not just a social commentary on prisons and crime and punishment in our society, but it goes deeper into just your life and why it is that sometimes you feel you're uncomfortable, you're being tortured, you're in a prison, you're confined, you've got no freedom. You don't need to change your wife. You don't need to swap your husband. You might get a worse one next time, who knows? So be grateful for the one you've got. You don't need to change your body. It's the same thing. You might get a worse one the next time. You don't need to change your life. This one is good enough. So change the attitude. So happy to be here. Happy to be with that woman you married many years ago. Happy to be with that man. Happy to be in that job. Happy to be. You can always make something out of it. If it's a hard job, you've got more to learn. It's wonderful if it's a difficult situation. If you're in a bad body, which is sick and dying, what a wonderful occasion that is to really learn and grow. Growing pains, remember, I always call it. So when one is happy to be here, then one is free. We all make our own prisons. We can all make our own freedom. And that actually is the deepest teaching of the Buddha of how to be free. It doesn't matter what situation you're in. It doesn't matter even when you're meditating. You think, oh, my mind's all over the place. It feels like a jail when you don't want your mind to be all over the place. If you're happy to be here, then you become free. And the mind stops moving then. Be happy to be here. Then you'll have all the freedom you want. Want it to be different, you are in jail. So each one of us is in prison. It's called the prison of samsara, the wheel of being born, growing old and dying, doing it all over again. the wheel of suffering. Why do we suffer? It's because of craving. It means I don't want to be here. I want something else. Give me something more. I want to be rich. When you're rich, I want to be poor. When you're a layperson, I want to be a monk. When you're a monk, you want to be a layperson. When you're single, you want to be married. When you're married, you want to be single. When you're old, you want to be young. When you're young, you want to be old. Oh, come on. I'd be happy to be here. If you're a monk, you're a monk. Be happy to be a monk. You're a layperson, be happy to be a layperson. You're married, be happy to be married. You're single, be happy to be single. You're gay, you're happy to be gay. You're heterosexual, you're happy to be heterosexual. You're sort of, whoever you are, just happy to be who you are. And then you're free. Now that's the ending of all prisons. Are you a crim? Are you a person who's committed a crime? Is your crime stupidity? That's a crime which you can forgive yourself any moment by learning how to be free. So, I've gone over time now. So, those of you happy to be here, I hope you're happy to be here because you were here. You might as well like it or lump it. So that's the talk for this evening on prison and freedom. Okay, has anyone got any questions, comments, complaints? Yes. Yeah, it'd be great to be able to do that, certainly. But it's not only myself, we've got a lot of other monks and also our lay community here. Many have actually been trained to go into those centres to visit the young people, not the crims. I will never visit a criminal. I'll visit a young person who's done a crime. So yeah, sure we'll do that. But I think the main thing is actually to get that message out to our society, because you know, I do read the newspapers, and one of the first things I need, actually the second thing I read in the newspapers, the first thing I read is the comics. Of course I read the comics in the newspapers. That's the best part in the comics, that's really the good news. People say the newspapers are all gloom and doom, but not the comics. The second thing is like the letters page. And there's just so much vindictiveness. And because of so much vindictiveness in our society and wanting revenge, sort of our politicians, they have to respond accordingly. And there's all this idea of like increasing sentences, making it more harsh. And you've seen that happen in all other, many, many jurisdictions. I must admit, I read about the penal system in the Netherlands. And I must admit, that's the one I admired the most. It was very much looking at crime as being some sort of sickness, to be healed, not to be punished. And the recidivism rate was very, very low. They forgave very quickly rather than punished. That was so inspiring to see. And it works. Everybody knows that the prison system in countries like Australia or the US, it doesn't work at all. Especially in Britain, they're always having to build more and more prisons, cost more and more money, doesn't really heal the situation at all. So it's like an epidemic which gets worse and worse and worse. It's okay, you have to stop crime, but deterrence don't work. Healing does. So yeah, it'd be great to be able to do that, but I think the real message needs to go out to society so we can have a different way of looking at these problems. Sorry? Yeah, I think so too, yeah. Especially into our society at large. Any other questions? Yeah? Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, indeed, sort of one personal experience with that has... some disciples some time ago, actually quite a few years ago, over 10 years ago now, who's a very interesting case. There were Buddhists who came to one of our meditation groups, and they came to me one day and they said there was big trouble. I wonder what that was this time, and apparently that they'd found out that her husband was sexually abusing her two kids. They're both 11 years old, two twins, boy and a girl. So... because she was a Buddhist and talked to her at length, in a very short time, she came to a state of forgiveness to her husband. Now, it didn't mean she could ever love him at all. There's no way he could continue being her husband. But forgiveness meant she was not wanting to seek revenge, to have him punished. She was not angry at that man. Sometimes when we say forgiveness, people misunderstand. It means, oh, you know, just it didn't happen. You can just carry on as normal. You can't carry on as normal. These things have their karmic results, consequence. So the marriage was over. She could never even like that person again, but she did not want to punish him or hurt him. And when she took that attitude, her two 11-year-olds followed very, very quickly. And the trouble, interesting part of this was, in those days, as now, there was compulsory counseling for the whole three of them. And she had to come to me to complain about her psychologist. Because she said in all those meetings, sessions with the psychologist said, you're angry at your husband, aren't you? You want revenge. She said, no, no, I've forgiven. That's denial. And so she was very patient with psychologists, but in the end she came to me, please, Ajahn Brahm, write a letter to her because she will not let me go until I admit something which I haven't got, which is anger. And so I had to actually write this letter to the psychologist, explaining in detail the Buddhist response to such problems and how forgiveness can come very quickly and how healthy such forgiveness is. And because of my letter, the psychologist freed her from the counselling. And I've kept in contact with that family. They moved to England, to Essex. I kept in contact all those years. One of the daughters now is a mother, and she's completely okay. Because of that forgiveness, the trauma, the scars of the so-called victims healed very quickly. I'm not sure what happened to the father. I know he went to jail, but not sure what's going on now. But that's for the victims. If the victims can give forgiveness for their sakes, it's a wonderful way of healing quickly. If they don't give that forgiveness, they are traumatized, maybe for life. If they don't give that forgiveness, the victims, the kids, are traumatized for life. They actually feel guilty. People who have been the subject of abuse, they feel that somehow it's my fault that I was raped. Sometimes I did something wrong. That guilt, again, is the same attitude. Instead of punishing someone else, you want to punish yourself. There's no way to go. Again, for those people who have done that, which I must admit, I find it impossible to contemplate how someone could do that to a kid. But it's obviously some sort of, people actually call them, you're sick to even think of something like that. If they do that, it's not something which punishment will help, but some sort of therapy, some sort of healing, some sort of way of making sure that never happens again. Punishment is not the way. And should be basically, it doesn't matter what you do, should be confined to protect children as long as it takes until that sickness is truly healed. You don't put people in jail because of punishment. You put it in people in a prison, like in a hospital, however long it takes, until they're free of that, I don't know what you call it, that syndrome. Does that make sense? In the back? Okay. A quarantine matter, yeah. And it doesn't... Correct. And you give the sentence not because of, you know, like saying that you've hurt a kid 30, 40 years. Or, you know, you've first time, only 2 years, whatever. It's however long it takes. Just like a sort of a disease. If it takes 10 years to get rid of that disease in the hospital, then that's been there for 10 years. If you can get rid of that disease in 2 weeks, fine. If you really be sure you're free of that disease, fine.